to another episode of Out from the Cube. We are still recording with guests from the DevUp conference that is in St. Charles, Missouri, right outside St. Louis. Yesterday, we recorded with Richard Campbell, who was the opening keynote, and we were fortunate to have him on. Again, I'd go back and listen to that episode. It was very valuable for me. I am on episode 41, 42, 43 of our podcast, and Richard had just recorded like episode 1500. And so he's been doing this much longer and has much more reach and impact than we have had. But I really appreciate the time that he spent with us, and because he gets pulled a number of different directions. But came in to day two of the conference today, and somebody that I'm very close with and have known for a number of years that listens to the podcast and knows the direction and kind of the message and vision of our podcast immediately came up to me and said, "Hey, George, you need to do whatever you can to get the closing keynote on your podcast as well." And so I hunted down Dean Furness, and to be honest with you, this morning prior to 8:30 a.m., I did not know who Dean Furness is. And now have spent, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes visiting with him about our podcast. And there's, without question, some similar passions of life. And so I'm very much looking forward to this. And with that, Dean, welcome to Out from the Cube. And I couldn't be more excited in just 10 or 15 minutes talking with you offline before we pressed record about how the next hour is going to impact me. I say this on my podcast, I'm very selfish with certain things. This podcast is very selfish. I want to learn, I want to meet people, and I want to take what I learn and then ultimately distribute it out to the people that listen to the podcast. So I think I'm going to get a lot out of this next hour.
Well,
so
yeah,
I'm super excited about it.
Thanks for having me, because I think the fact that you are selfish is what makes it good, right? Because if you would want to listen to it, then surely you've got an audience of one, right?
Yeah, I've got an audience of one.
But glad to be here. Pretty excited. This conference is one that I hold pretty special, just from knowing many of the folks that have put it on in the past and have spoken at it in previous years many times. It's just always good to get back to St. Charles in the area.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No. Again, really appreciate. I think it's going to be a great hour. This rarely. So we're on episode 42. I've listened to maybe three of the podcasts. I don't like listening to myself. There have just been a number of guests that we've had, and I take a lot of notes, as people that listen to the podcast know. And I know this will be something that I will circle back to and make sure I get everything written down and don't miss anything that you have to say. The first thing that we have in common, as we kind of got to know each other a little bit, is my background is really in coaching. I spent 15 years or so coaching small college basketball at some NAIA type schools up in Michigan, and you immediately smiled when I kind of said that, and because your background, not that it's your background, but you have a similar passion and interest and time spent in coaching as well, right?
Yeah, so this fall will be my sixth or seventh year of coaching our high school girls varsity basketball team. Mm. I was asked to join the team for my head coach about 6 years ago, and that's coming in off of having just a strong background in athletics as it is. Right. And I just can't wait. November 6th cannot get here quick enough for us to start practice and start another year. We have a small school. We're a public school. It's a class 1A school in Iowa, and that essentially means that K through 12 is in one building.
Right.
There are 40 to 45 kids per grade, not classroom, but per grade. And so that means our team, freshman through senior, ends up being 13, 14, 15, maybe up to 18 kids total. And so we have a very personal relationship with every one of the kids. There isn't a defined, you're a freshman, you don't get to play varsity or anything like that. If you have the talent, you're playing. Maybe not talent, but athleticism and attitude and work effort and all those things that go into it. So it's an exciting time for us. We work all summer, and then August 1st, we're done for the summer, and we just wait until November to get here. So
now, Iowa, does Iowa have the – like six-man basketball or
used that, to yeah
used
so
to, right?
I graduated high school in 1990, and sometime between then and a little later they switched over to 5-on-5, but six-player basketball is interesting. Two dribbles and you have to pass.
Two dribbles and anywhere on the floor or just in the backcourt?
So you are a defined forward or a defined guard. If you're a guard, you don't cross half court and you only play defense, and if you're a forward, you play offense and that's it. Yeah. And so it's not uncommon at that time if you had a solid offensive game. It's not uncommon for a player in that era in women's basketball, girls' basketball, to have, you know, 70, 80 points per game average. I mean, literally. One of our other assistant coaches, her name is Jill, she ended up in the state title game and was one of those players, just unstoppable.
Wow.
You know, and it's just fun having her on the team. And then we have another coach as well. His name's RJ.
Boy, the strategy to that. So, you know, like I said, I've been involved with basketball ever since I can remember. And strategy and drawn up plays and X's and O's. And the strategy and the mindset shift that would have to take place for that game. That's a different game.
So it's a 3-on-3 half-court game with two dribbles to pass.
Yeah. That's
a So imagine 3-on-3, which we all play.
Right.
And if you get the ball as a defender, your job is to get it across half court to pass to your offense to play 3-on-3 the other way. You're not just going outside three-point line and checking and coming back.
Right.
You have to get it across half court.
Right.
When the ball is scored, the referee takes it out of the net, whips it up to center court, and then the offense takes over. So there's no out-of-bounds, like full-court press. There's none of that.
That's interesting.
It is a different game.
And they don't do it anymore?
They stopped doing it. So now I think we have five classes of girls basketball in the state of Iowa, all 5-on-5. And the, you know, the smaller schools, and as you get bigger, the talent level, the athleticism certainly changes.
Right. So you grew up in Iowa, and your background athletically, you mentioned was football. You played high school and college football?
I went to high school, a 2A school in high school. So there's 70 of us in our grade-ish, somewhere in there. So I played football, basketball, and golf. Played some baseball, but decided the golf course was more fun.
Right.
So for the summer, I did that. But, yeah, then went to play football at a D3 school in Pella, Iowa, named Central College, and one of 120 members on the team, and totally, it moved me in a direction that I didn't know until, you know, later in life when you have to start drawing on some of those things, those experiences that you had at the college level, and, you know, those friends, those lifelong friends that you make on those teams, just amazing.
Yeah. So. Something about athletics and teams and connection and, that kind of shared suffering is a phrase that we've used before. The shared suffering that kind of brings people together and just understanding how teams work.
There's a lot to that experience in that. My older brother is a year older than me, had already gone to that school, and I wanted to follow him there. I mean, it was only an hour from home. It wasn't any big deal. I didn't have any idea what I was going to study, but I knew I wanted to play football and be with my brother again. And he ran track there. And a couple years later, my younger brother showed up. So we had three brothers at school at the same time there. And, you know, that when you're on campus and you've got 120 guys that are all fighting for the same thing, you know, and you have a coach by the name of Ron Skipper, who has now passed away. And he was in his 60s when he was coaching us in 1990 to 94. And the things that we were able to draw from, you know, every day there was a life lesson. Every day there was a conversation about things. And it really started with things I think are kind of missing today. We had some basic rules on the team. Your hair is above your collar. There's no facial hair. You're taking your hat off when you're inside and you're eating. You know, you open the door for folks. I mean, all those sorts of rules that are just kind of the do right things.
Right.
And it was all based on his attitude of you're a student, you're an athlete, and you're a gentleman, in that order. And if you can own up to those three things, you can be part of the team. There wasn't a tryout and a cut or anything like that. You're on the team. You want to work hard. You can come out and play.
All right. There's something about let me ask you this. I love that stuff because I love teams and programs and businesses and whatever it might be that have standards.
Yeah.
And they uphold those standards, which kind of we've talked about, kind of creates your culture and all that.
Sure.
But let me ask you this: who enforced those standards more on those teams, the coaching staff, or the player, or the juniors or seniors?
That's
a business lesson.
So
right?
I think there's a business
lesson in there.
I remember specifically as a freshman. Huddling around as a group of players without coaches there early in the season. And there was an upperclassman with the last name of Sanger. Anybody listening from Central will know who I'm talking about. And he's basically saying, you know, hey, it's a dry campus. So the college was dry campus. And we all know what that means. It's dry unless you get caught a lot of times, right? But we held true to it, I think, in season. We just, you know, there wasn't anything going on that way. And one of the seniors basically said, you know, this guy named Kevin, it's not that it won't bother you. It's the fact you said you wouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. You made an agreement to be here. And we'll take care of things if you decide to go against that agreement. Right. And that's all you needed to hear when you're a little freshman and you've got this senior looking. And, yeah.
Yeah, there's something. So, again, to draw my experiences as a coach, you kind of feel as that head coach or somebody that's on staff when you see things like that happening, mm-hmm. where you kind of swell up with some pride to it, and you're sitting there like, we're getting to where we need to be. We're like when you see people buy in, yeah. and you don't have to, you could spend 4, 5, 6, 7 years trying to beat these standards into people that you're leading and that are on your team. But when you kind of self-monitor or self-enforce mm-hmm. from the players or the employees to the new hires or the new recruits or the freshmen or the transfers, this mindset, and we do have a podcast. It was one of our first five where it was titled What's Us and What's Not Us, you know, and to the senior that is saying, hey, this is a dry campus. That's us.
Yep.
That's who we are. That's what we stand for. And I actually remember when I was coaching, we had players that would come to us in the office and say, coach, so-and-so's not going to make it here. Like, mm-hmm. you know, and we would say, thank you. We would monitor it. And then we would be like, yeah. So when you get kind of that self-enforcement from your people yep. on standards. And again, I love the comparison of sports to business. Mm-hmm. I love it because I do think that's a business leadership team at Wells Fargo, at Google, or wherever, mm-hmm. Where you get people that are all in.
Right.
All in on what's going on.
And that makes all the difference in the world. So for us, and again, some people probably heard me speak to this quite often. The 4 years I was there, we lost 5 games. We were 36-5 in those 4 years. Wow. And if I tell you that we were an average team for that school.
Oh, really?
Right. So we were – and I went through – for one of my talks, I did some analysis of I took a four-year block and every four-year chunk, mm-hmm. kind of rolling 4 years.
Right.
I think my team, the 4 years I was there, we ranked number 8th all time in all of those four-year progressions from the mid-60s on. So Coach Skipper jumped into Central in the 60s, mm-hmm. and my team was in the midst of years number 31, 32, or 33 of consecutive winning seasons. Mm. And so we were an average team.
Wow.
Right? So you look at, go 8 years prior to me, and they went to 2 national championship games, you know, and you go and look back at wherever else is there. If any of those senior graduating classes had lost more than 5 or 6 games in their career, that was the abnormal part of it. And so we really were brought up, and it plays into a lot of what I think the business is, that being average is something that I'll talk about today. Is it's your average, right? Don't compare my record to somebody else's record, but we're trying to get just a little bit better on our own to make mm-hmm. our average better, and it made all the difference in the world. And even at work, right? Work's easy, you know. Going into work and doing work is so easy. There are some challenges, sure, but an average day doesn't have to mean it's a ho-hum day, right?
Right.
An average day can be something you really excel at, and people will start to look at you and say, wow, you're really overachieving. Like, no, it's just another day. We were brought up through that coaching experience and then through that team that, you know, if you just own up and do the right thing, so be it. So as an example, film session every day was mm-hmm. you know, a lot of fun, especially being a wide receiver. And back then, there weren't HD cameras, so film was on the lineman, not
right.
on the wide receiver. Mm. So I sat through 2 hours of film every day, never being on the camera. Mm. So if I messed up, oh, darn, right? But when you have to sit there and you see one of your buddies on the line taking the wrong step, taking a left foot step instead of a right when the ball snapped, and the play failing because of that, and the coach clicking it back and forth and back and forth, it sets into your head that, you know, number one, you made an agreement to your buddies you're going to do it right, and secondly, that minor little mishap changed everything for everyone, and that accountability was set in
right.
so quick. It's a big deal, and, you know, at work, being accountable for what you're going to do is a big part of that, and for me, it's just second nature. It's like, well, it's my job, that's what I'm going to do. It's not a struggle.
Right.
So.
Right. So to get into your story a little bit more, so you played mm-hmm. – were you always a geek? You and I are very similar, right? I'm in the software world as well. I've written code for 10 years. I'm slowly writing less code, but I do work with IT teams and things of that nature. In my heart, I feel like I'm a coach. And probably will always feel that way.
Sure.
And the podcast is very slanted athletically into sports stories and things of that nature. But you were kind of, are you kind of that same way? What's the ratio geek to jock here?
Oh boy, I'm not that athletic. I was a role player, right? I'll put it this way. I went to school there, number one, to be with my brother, secondly, for football, and third, I had to come out of there with a degree of some sort. I ended up leaving with a math degree. A comp sci minor. And I think I went with math because it's pretty black and white. The answer is right or it's wrong. There isn't a professor that may or may not like the paper I've written. If the answer is right, it's right.
Right.
And so I left scared to death of public speaking. Never wanted to do any of that. Not that I was a poor reader or poor writer, just the numbers were easier. So I landed a job in Des Moines out of college doing database administration. And so everything that I started with was related to SQL and data and all those things. And thankfully, because that's a big part of today that in the IT world that you can have some serious impact. You know, in this conference, this DevUp conference, I don't consider myself a developer. I don't know .NET. I don't know Java. I don't know many of the sessions that they're presenting on. I have no idea what they're talking about.
Right.
But we get into the data world and my day-to-day world of creating dashboards and telling stories with the information to help an executive make a decision. That's where I sit. So there's not so much jock there, right? I mean, you can get an all-conference accolade in high school and then go to college and be nobody. So it never really was part of who I was. Prototypical team player. Do my job. We all celebrate together and go from there. So
right. So you spent who did you work for when you got out of college and went to
company and Principal Financial Group in Des Moines. Still there. My wife's been there for almost 30 years now.
Oh, really?
Working there. And I left there to go work for Blue Cross Blue Shield and then ended up working for a consulting firm here out of St. Charles named Quilogy, which many of the people in the area know about, before then going to Wells Fargo. So
okay. Yep. So you worked there, and you were just working remote up in Iowa.
Yeah.
And then to get into, had a life-changing moment at some point. I don't know the full story exactly what happened, but I'm interested. At some point, your life changed dramatically.
Yeah, there was an event. So December of 2011, it was one of those winters oncoming where people were playing golf in January in Iowa because it was so warm. You know, it would freeze at night, and the thaw to be 50 degrees and back and forth, and when that happens, there's, you know, the top 1 inch of the ground gets a little slippery. The ground is frozen underneath, and it thaws out and whatever. And I bring that up because we live on an acreage. We have 10 acres. My wife grew up with horses, and so the week after we moved into the house, we had a horse with no fence, and that's a life-changing event, by the way. And so I went out that evening around 5 o'clock to take one of those large hay bales and put it in a bale ring for the horses to eat out of, just do chores before my wife came home. It was a Wednesday night. And I screwed up. I didn't strap the bale in correctly in the loader, and it fell off the loader and crushed me in the seat of the tractor. And so I was all of maybe 10 car lengths from the house. You know, I wasn't out in the middle of a cornfield or whatever. And so I knew right away that I couldn't feel my legs. I was conscious the whole time. Ended up waiting about 45 minutes to an hour before somebody found me. I mean, I was that close to the house, and this is what it was. Ended up with a free helicopter ride to the hospital, and woke up with a T6 paralysis, so a complete paraplegic from that point forward. So T6 is like where your xiphoid process is, or right at the base of your sternum. So from there down, I've lost all use of my body. Thankfully, you know, I saw my hands and my head and heart and all that. But it was interesting. You know, I have, and to this day, my wife's like, it's amazing. There was no bruising. I broke a couple of ribs. I broke my T6 vertebrae, and my sternum had a little crack in it. And, you know, I didn't have any soft tissue damage aside from my spinal cord inside, which thankfully, right, I mean, I didn't have to worry about a punctured lung or a spleen or whatever. So it happened so suddenly that there was nothing that they could do it. So the reason I brought the ground up is that I had started to move the bale, and the tractor just slowly slid Started to glide on the ground, and we're not talking it was rolling or anything like that, but there was enough of a slide to it that I was nervous I was going to slide into this brush pile that we had. And I turned around to see where it was at, and when I turned it around, the loader on the tractor must have kept going up, and I didn't even see it. I was looking backwards, and then that bale came down and landed on me. So it's probably good that I didn't notice it, because I didn't flinch, didn't do whatever. It just what happened, you know. So you take that experience. You spend, you know, December 14th, somewhere in there. December 14th, 2011. You go through Christmas and New Year's at a general hospital, just the normal hospital in Des Moines, trying to figure out what's going to happen. And you learn to fight really quick. And so my wife...
not to cut you off.
No, you're fine.
I apologize.
Yep.
That's you learn to fight really quick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's an interesting phrase. Because some people probably choose not to fight.
Yeah.
Right. And knowing your background a little bit, and knowing where this conversation probably will end up with how successful you've been, how you've overcome things. When you say you learn to fight really quick, what do you mean? Like, is that something you just had in you? Or because you're talking about maybe like a week or two months after this happens, you go December, January, February, and you learn to fight real quick.
Yeah.
Whereas I might sit there and learn how to quit real quick.
So small community has a lot, you know, and tight family has a lot to it as well. That Wednesday I was hurt. That following week, that Tuesday or whatever, the community had already spun up fundraisers and chili dinners and all this stuff to move us forward, you know, as a family. And I remember one moment in the hospital shortly after everything happened where it's just me and my wife, and you know, it was maybe 4 or 5 minutes of just right, a couple of tears, and from that point forward, we were moving forward.
Wow.
And I think I've never felt that I was a victim. I've never felt that, why am I being punished? It happened. And so the question is, what are you going to do? And with the community jumping in, with the family jumping in, part of me is like, I can't let them down. They're my team. My job is to do my part. And if they're going to invest all this time and caring into me getting better, then I need to do my part and own up to that. And it wasn't like, yeah, let's go get me in the wheelchair and let's move. You know, there's certainly a lot of work that went into that. But mentally, it was very quick for me and my family to make the change.
Hmm.
And then my daughters maybe struggled a little more, and there's still days I think where it frustrates them more than it bothers me.
Right.
At our house, it's difficult for them because we don't use the word can't very often.
Mm.
And, you know, it's always in front of them that sucking it up is your option right now. That's it. You have to move on. I'm sorry it hurts a little bit, but let's get moving. So, yeah, you learn to fight. And fight ends up being, I don't know if it's the right word or not, but you certainly learn to accept the challenges and then go in with a healthy feeling that you're going to win no matter what anyways, because you have to,
right?
And there isn't an option. Now, it might take a little longer to get there, but I think from that next day forward, I lost some time in there. I remember landing at the hospital and getting pulled off the helicopter, but I don't remember how much time from that point until, you know, I was in my room. I don't know if it was 12 hours, 4 hours, or 3 days. You know, I think maybe, you know, it was hours.
Right.
But when you wake up and you realize what's going on, it's like you get moving right away. There's no time.
Hmm.
And I kind of call it kind of your recovery time. So there's a part of the talk today in the closing keynote about, you know, today's world, something happens, and the first thing people do is they'll dig their heels in and fight that it's happening. And you lose time when you do that. And it's inevitable. It's already happened. So why are you digging your heels in? It's time to get past that. And then they'll open up social media and tell everybody how bad a day it is. And they will then wait for people to affirm that, yeah, it's a bad day, and they hit the like button. And before they finally decide, okay, I need to move on with things. And you've just lost 4 hours of your day waiting for that. And so compressing that recovery time to look at, okay, it happened, and now we got to move on, is really important. And it gets back to coaching. One of the things, one of the key tenets that our head coach tells our girls, and it's especially crucial in basketball, is there's always a next. There's only one time in your life there's not a next, and that's when you've passed away. And in basketball, you don't have time to stomp a foot or roll your eyes or or do whatever. The call went against you. You turn around, you run, you get back, and you keep playing. Otherwise, you've missed it. And so we will always tell the girls there's always a next. You just ran a sprint, get on the line, there's a next. Forget how much that hurt, we're going again. And it's immediate. And so I really try to approach things that way. I mean, I've got stories of Social Security Administration wanting all the benefits back they'd given me. I've got stories of healthcare deciding that they weren't going to cover me. You know, and you appeal and you win, you know, the 2-year fight to get a new wheelchair because they decline it. I mean, I'm not going to wallow around for 3 weeks saying, woe is me that it didn't work. Where's the appeal form? Let's go. You know, let's keep getting after it. And otherwise you waste time. And I don't want to waste time.
I would say that maybe your sport background plays a lot in that. Yeah. I think there's so a friend of mine that comes on the podcast every once in a while corrected me on this, and I appreciated his correction. I keep using the word training. He was like, you train a dog, you develop people. But that development mindset that you created through maybe athletics or who do you feel? Maybe your parents, maybe your college coach, maybe your high school coach. But there's that mindset. I do believe that is developed. Sometimes I'm sure you have it or you don't.
And I don't think I'm done, right? And I don't think you ever are done with that. So my answer is going to be through a progression of 20 or 30 years of how that happened. You know, there's four of us kids. We grew up. My folks worked their butts off, and we were, you know, I don't understand how we had every Star Wars toy we wanted growing up, but yet my folks seemed like they didn't make very much money. How that happened, I don't know. But as soon as we were able to push the lawnmower, we were pushing the lawnmower. You know, we were out working, and work ethic was a big, big part of it. You know, kids these days don't know what it means to walk beans, you know, or, you know, just hassling corn is one thing. I never had to do that, but to work hard is a part of that. And I think for my parents and how hard they worked, that's where it started. High school, you know, not so much, but going to college with that football coach was important. And then it continues. After I was hurt, the head football coach at the high school said, you got to come help us now. And so I coached football for about 5 years. And he's a gentleman that played in our arch rival school in college, though I never get to play against him. But he was the guy. He was the All-American linebacker and so on. But having him ask me to come in and help coach football was a huge part to me turning things around. You know, I was a part of something. I was a part of a team again. And a couple months later, the head girls coach, basketball coach, asked me, do you want to come help us too? I'm like, oh, absolutely. You know, I'd love to do that. And ever since, I've stopped doing football and doing just basketball with only daughters and stuff. Just the time commitment is what it is. And I think, you know, those teams and having a role in those teams has been very important. And as of late, because basketball is what it is, I've got a new team now that I've started to work with, or at least they've let me talk to them. They've included me over at University of Illinois with the wheelchair racing team there. And to be brought in by them and included as a 46-year-old, and they're in their early 20s, and they're competing and racing at the top levels in the world, and having access to that and being on that team, you know, in air quotes, is really important to me.
So you mentioned actually earlier just about that. I'm interested in you said that you completed your third marathon this past week.
Yeah, so Chicago
Marathon. Is that part of that group?
Yeah, so Chicago Marathon was on Sunday a couple of days ago, and that was my third. I did Grandma's Marathon in Duluth in June, and then Chicago last year was my first. So it's interesting. I consider my team, you know, beyond family and friends, but my physical therapist is a huge part of my team.
Right.
You know, my doctors and you know, my friends, I call them my team. But my PT in spring of 2016 said, hey, you should go do this half marathon. I'm like, I'm in a wheelchair, and I don't like running if I weren't in a wheelchair. But at that time, I had been pushing around the city streets just to get in shape. I have an attachment that goes in my wheelchair that makes it kind of like a tricycle, to where the front wheels, the small wheels, are off the ground, and it's got kind of a kid's bicycle tire in the front, and I can push forever. He said, you should go do a half marathon. So I pushed my first half marathon in June of 2016 in a chair like you see me sitting in now, just with that attachment on it. And the support that you got from people as they're running by you,
the support you get as people running by you is
it's pretty invigorating in the race. And then when you're passing them, when they're breathing hard, it's kind of fun too, because the wheels help, right? Mm-hmm. But I went from that, and then, so it was June. August, I stalked out a gentleman over at the University of Illinois, happened to be the head coach of the team over there, and happened to be that they're a couple of weeks from going to Rio for the Olympics. And I don't know, that year they took some 14 athletes, came home with 17 medals and whatever. And in the meanwhile of that preparation, he answered an email that I'd sent and basically said, hey, I'd really like to try racing, but I don't want to spend the money on a chair until I know if I can do it. And he said, come on over. So invited a stranger over, and that afternoon I came home with a chair. He said, here, try this out. And he sent me home. So 7-hour drive. Never.
So we're talking
the head coach of the team.
Of Illinois now, Champaign.
In so Champaign,
okay,
yeah.
So you're going from somewhere in Iowa. I'm not sure exactly.
Des Moines, yeah. So 7-hour drive to Champaign.
Wow.
He brings me into the facility and gives me a couple, tips and tricks. We get to know each other a little bit. Similar age. He's a little bit younger than I am. And he said, here, try this out. And sent me home with a chair. No questions asked. No whatever. Just let me know how it goes. Let me know if you need help. Meanwhile, he's packing to go, down to Argentina. So that's great. I got home and realized real quick that and talk about upping the game a little bit. It's different than pushing in a regular chair. It continued to where I didn't because it was September, October. It got cold. Come February, he writes me and says, I need the chair back, and my heart sunk. It's like, it was just getting warm. I'm just going to start getting into it. So I said, you bet I'll be right over. And we drove over the next week, and he sent me home with another chair. He said, I just need this one back. You can use this one now. And he said, oh, by the way, let's measure you for your own chair. And he took down all the measurements because they're all custom built to your size. Some of the people on the team have, were born with defects, and their legs are much smaller than my 39-year-old full-grown legs before I got hurt. And so the size of the cage that you sit in and the chair matters. So we measured, and we ordered me my chair. And as I'm leaving, he says, what are you doing in October? I'm like, it's February. I have no idea. He says, let's do Chicago Marathon. I'm like, you're kidding. Mm-hmm. And so it started from there. And so last summer, I spent, the summer getting about 500 miles of training in, thinking I was doing well. Show up for Chicago Marathon, and I had done my homework. I'd stalked YouTube and watched all the video I could watch. I knew all the big names. The night before the race, they had a meeting for all of us wheelchair athletes. And talk about feeling like an imposter. You're looking around, it's like, oh my gosh, that's Marcel, and that's Tatiana, and that's Josh, and that's Pike. All these names come out. Like, they have so many Paralympic medals around their neck that why am I in this room? And there were 70 of us there, and I didn't know anybody except that coach, Adam. He did one more thing. He invited me to stay for dinner with the team after that meeting. And so a year ago this weekend, I met what I consider my team, a bunch of kids, and they don't like it when I say that, so they'll listen to this and they'll make fun. But they're 20, 22, 23, 25 years old. And they just pulled me in. Any question I have about racing, anything that I'm doing, they send me the workouts. I have a question about what the workout means. And essentially that turned into me going back to Champaign 4 or 5 times this year, spending a week in the training facility working out with them. They invited me back for their high school camp, so I helped out with the camp there. And in the end, they pushed me to put in over 1,000 miles of training this summer, and this is about 50 to 70 miles a week. And here we are.
Wow.
I'm back to Chicago, and they're dear friends. It's just amazing. They're my kids. They're my kids' age.
Wow.
But it's my team, and all because a stranger answered an email and said, go for it. And you speak to, and I know I'm rambling with it, but
no.
To complete a marathon, you're about 10,000 strokes with your arms to get through 26 miles. You sign up for the punishment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's you have to go in knowing mentally what you're getting yourself into. And it sounds like a lot, right? The best in the world are going to complete that marathon with a 3-minute 30-second mile pace, right? And the best runners, a 4-minute mile is a really big deal. And to finish a marathon, like the record was just broke not too long ago, right at 2 hours, well, the best wheelchairs in the world are going to beat an hour and a half. I mean, they're 30 minutes faster than that. So, you know, I'm at a point now where I'm so much a rookie that I'm aiming for a 15 mile an hour pace. If I could get, you know, under 2 hours right now is a really good marathon. My best is 1:53. But boy, it'd be fun to get another 10 minutes off and then, you know, go from there. Not to be silly, right? I mean, the elite of the elite are who they are, and it's just pretty cool that they include me and they'll talk with me and stuff. But it's just fun to compete, if you will. So,
man, there's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah, sorry.
But, no. I think that's amazing. I think this is amazing. This is what strikes me about what you just said is, one, the impact and value and how one person can really change and alter our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Reaching out to somebody and having that person just have a servant heart, to be willing to say, hey, come here and I'll take care of you, essentially. I'll do, like, what are your goals? How can I help? What can I provide? And I think that's business. I think that's leadership, of the people that we're leading and the companies that we're in charge of or the products. I think all that sort of stuff. I also think for you to take those steps and say, hey, I'm gonna go 7 hours, because that I'm guessing relies on other people to help you to make that seven.
Just take a day off from work. I drug my dad with me.
Right. You know,
just to make the trip.
Right.
You know, he's retired. He needed something to do.
Yeah.
So.
And I think what I think people in our profession either don't lend a lot of weight to or don't consider a lot is the value of the team. Mm-hmm. And as simple as that sounds, I think there's a lot in there. A sense of belonging, feeling connected, being inspired, being accountable, achieving something, becoming great or better than what you were yesterday. We don't put a whole lot of value in that, or we don't spend as much time as we need considering the impact that has.
Mm-hmm.
So when your eyes light up because you're a part of that team, and when your teammates are kids, essentially, right? That's how I would view it.
Yes.
That's what I would say about 23.
Both high school and also the college kids,
But not to tell my own story at all, but I went there's a NBA basketball coach that I admired for years named George Karl. He was at one point the head coach of the Seattle Supersonics, Denver Nuggets, and Sacramento Kings.
Sure.
He was out of coaching for a while. And when he was out of coaching, I met him, was able to go out to lunch with him, essentially spent a week with him, drove him around Detroit, all this sort of stuff. And I went out, and he was not in coaching, and it was the first time he was not leading or participating in a team. And we were at an old diner in Rochester Hills, Michigan, and his eyes welled up. He was about to just start sobbing. And he said, George, this is the first time in my life I'm not a part of a team. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard for me.
Yeah.
And there's so much that is wrapped up in being a part of a team. And that always stuck with me because it is belonging and connecting. So you found that. How has that continued to impact you, and how is that accountability and that drive? And you've probably already said that, but how do you translate that into the teams you lead or the place you work or how you see other teams? Because that's impactful.
And it's different. So with the high school girls, they have seen me. Some of them may not remember me walking. Mm-hmm. You know, it's at least 7 years this December. They get a full dose of my general approach to being in a wheelchair. There will be jokes. I will make fun of myself. I'll say something to see if they'll laugh because they're nervous. Like, wait, he just said that. Can I laugh about that? And I want them to laugh. But so much of it is that I believe that they leave being so comfortable around somebody that's just got a little bit of a different approach to getting around. You know, the wheelchair is ever present for them in practice. They get it. They know they have to make sure they pass the ball to me a certain way, which you would think that would be an easy skill in basketball, right? Just make a good pass. You know, that type of interaction is one thing. I go to work, and with Wells being such a big company, many people I work with have no idea I'm in a wheelchair. No idea. I'm on the phone for 2 years on a project with them, and we'll meet in person, and it's tough. Like, they don't know what to say, you know, and I just go with it. You know, let's just talk about it. Let's make it happen. The team in Illinois is interesting because they are all also in some way, shape or form, have a handicap that they're fighting with or working through. And, you know, some were born with a defect. Some had injuries like I had. And in the end, we're all in wheelchairs at some point or with a prosthetic or whatever. And it's amazing how in that conversation, let me back up. When you talk about, when you engage with people that are new to the idea of the wheelchair, the conversation is about the wheelchair. Mm. When I'm in Illinois and working with those friends, we're talking about, should I take grad school? Should I take a year off, or should I go right into grad school? That's a conversation I had with one of those kids, you know, a couple weeks ago. And it's not about the wheelchair, because we're already all in that state. And it gets to be very real in terms of back to life. Mm-hmm. The fact that they're asking me, old guy, for advice that way, with, you know, three daughters their same age, is pretty flattering. At the same time, I think there's, you know, some perspective they're looking for there that just might be another voice besides their parents pushing them or their coach pushing them and so on. So it's a different conversation. And the leadership there, I really look up to them in terms of, you know, shoot, your balance in school and a workout, you're an elite athlete, like top five in the world athlete. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you pull that off? Whereas I'm trying to fight 40 hours of work and life and then also get the training in. So there's some motivating factors there for me, but at the same time, the conversation is different. It's totally different.
Hmm. How much time do you spend training?
50 to 70 miles a week, so 6 days a week for sure. Mm-hmm. I'll get a workout in. I built a roller, so just like any bicycle in the wintertime would have a roller. I at the facility in Illinois, they have a whole bunch of them, so I modeled one after that and just built one. Had some people help me. So I'll get on that roller, and, you know, 45-minute workout is a 9 to 10-mile workout, pretty easy on the roller. And so there'll be a couple of days of that, a couple of days at the track. And then in Iowa, we have the fortunate set of bike trails that are old railroad tracks that have been paved over. And so they're really nice trails, and they're safe for me. I can actually get on them without traffic going by. But on a Saturday, it's usually a 20-mile-plus push. You know, and then during the week, there's days where you go 15, other days you only go 8 or 9, other days you're on the track doing a different kind of workout, but it's 6 days a week of getting it in.
So one of the themes from this week when we were talking with Richard yesterday, and something I've probably hit on the past couple episodes, and I feel like the message that I continue to hear is really for me. It's kind of one of those things like you spend your week doing a bunch of things that you shouldn't be doing, and then you go to church and the preacher's preaching at you and you're like, man, that's exactly, he is talking to me or he was watching me all week.
Yep.
But it's, you know, it's wanting a better life. It's wanting to get out of our cubicles. It's wanting to be more connected, accomplish more, reach our goals, waking up every day inspired and be passionate about something. But I always fall short on action and taking the first step and not thinking too much and not planning too much and not taking too many notes, but actually getting out and doing and doing and mm-hmm. doing. That's not a problem for you.
No, was, right? I think that's one of the things I learned. I've had to learn patience, like really learn patience. When you come out of a rehab hospital like that, I mean, we get spit out, amped up on the opiates, I mean, the OxyContin and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a very real thing. And it's a deal where I can totally get the epidemic, right, that's out there, that's in the news. When you come out of that environment and you're somewhat numb because of that, I made a decision pretty quick that I was angry at the time. I was an angry person. I was very impatient, and I believe it had a lot to do with the medication that they put us on. And after a couple months being home, there was an event where I spilled something in the house, and I was very angry about it. So I picked it up, and I threw it down on the floor again and made it worse. And I think that something clicked because my kids were around when that happened. And I said, I got to stop. And so I just quit taking them. I'd rather hurt and know what needed fixed than have it be numb anymore. And so the patience behind waiting for somebody to reach something for me, or just the simple stuff that way. I'm pretty efficient on my own, but there are things that I just can't get to it. To have to wait, you learn that. And so day to day, specifically with the working out, it becomes very easy to talk myself out of my workout. So, and we've all done that. Like, yeah. you wake up, it's like, gosh, I know I'm supposed to go 12 miles tonight. I wonder if the weather's going to be okay, because I might just not be able to get it in. And, oh, work's going to run late. And I find that preparing for the marathon has been a huge change for me. There aren't wheelchair marathon preparation schedules, but you can go find one for runners everywhere. Here's what you should run every day, and right. you should have this recovery day and run – you know, run these intervals, splits, and whatever. And so I've adapted the workouts that have been given to me from the coach and the friends in Illinois into one of those running workouts. So as I'm preparing for Boston next year, in January, I will be starting back up through a progression leading up to April. And I will have that schedule built. And every day for those 12 weeks or whatever it is, I will know what I'm doing. And I find, at least with the week, even if you sit down at Sunny and you plan out the week, it's really hard to talk yourself out of your workout when that plan is there.
Yeah.
If you wake up every day randomly, you know what, today I think I might do a roller, or today I might go to the track. And the other part with running and the wheelchair side of it is going to the track is hard. And it's hard because, number one, I don't like going in circles. That's why I golfed. I didn't want to run track. I mean, it's a circle, right? And aside from the surface being something that has a lot of drag to it, which you might think doesn't, but it does, every lap you pass your car. Every lap, time to go home. Is it time to go home yet? Is it time to go home yet? And there's a real mental challenge there for me. I have to find a way next year in my progression into this sport with embracing being at the track as being healthy for me. It'll build my strength. It'll make me a better racer. But when you're on the bike trail and you leave your car behind 5 miles, mm-hmm.
5 miles back,
you got to go back, right? And so it is that way, right? And I think having, and then it may sound just too elementary, it's not that I have a plan, it's that I'm not going to let myself down on that plan. I'm not going to talk myself out of it if I have it written down. So it makes a difference.
All right, so I'm torn between two questions here. We'll get to them both. You've got to be really impactful to these people you're leading, is what I'm thinking. Everything you're saying, but really what you've overcome, how you train, how you've asked for help and received it. That's a thing, that's a source of contention in my household with my children. You know, if you don't know something, you know, it's that mindset. One of my kids, he does not like asking for help when he struggles with something academic. And that's a hard thing to ask for help. And
we had a leader at Wells. One of the things that I do with data is also deal with something called a strategy mapping and KPI development, metric development, right? And because there's math and there's data and everything behind that. But the true value of the strategy map is it shows a cause and effect relationship between the KPIs. So if you do not train your people, your project is going to fall behind. That project's going to fall behind. Your customer will be impacted and your financials will be impacted. So it's this whole, what are you measuring and why you're measuring it? One of the leaders was challenged by his boss to put together a plan or whatever, and we caught word of it, and a buddy and I just asked him, can we help you? And we, you know, had a quick half hour, and as we're leaving, he says, thank you, nobody ever asks if I need help.
Wow.
And as a leader, you know, that's pretty impactful for us, you know. And it wasn't about, you know, promotion or whatever. We had a skill, we saw he had a need, and why look at an org chart and say, well, I can't talk to him because he's above me? That's not it at all. But it was the other way around. He's like, nobody ever asks if I need help. You know, it's one thing for me to ask for, but,
right.
you know, when's the last time you asked two or three up from you, can I help you?
Right. So you said something on the way up here, actually, when we were coming up to the room or recording, and you said something along these lines. So correct me on exactly how you said it. But it was essentially managing up. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what you're saying now. Mm-hmm. You know, training the managers above you on either how to manage or communicate or lead the people below them, or how you individually like to be led or communicated to. You do a lot of, like,
yeah, it's maybe not maybe not with a purpose in mind other than it just happens, right? And it's very much more for me, not to give advice to him about how to manage the team. It's more of, I've never relied on my manager, my boss, my workplace to drive my career. I felt that's up to me. If I have a goal, it's my job to manage my manager to help me get there. I mean, certainly I'll share with him, and that goal may not have anything to do with what he wants out of it. Like, and I shared with him, I'm speaking a keynote down here. I shared with him, I'm going to Chicago. I'm doing all these things. And as long as my work is done, we make that happen. And so he understands that I have those related and unrelated things that I'm chasing because I've communicated those with him. And it's more so than just, hey, I've got a concert for my kid that I need to go to, right? There's, you know, the basketball season will change my work schedule. 3 o'clock every day, I'm at the gym. And so I need to get in and get my work done. And basically he... And I usually have my manager help me clear the runway so I can get the stuff done that I need to get done. And that's really a big part of it. Just keep communicating with him. Mm-hmm. Let him know where I'm going, what I need to have done. And, yeah, I might not get to that till 9 o'clock tonight, but I'll get there. Right? And so it's I don't know if training the manager or managing the manager or managing up, it's all part of that. And it really comes just down to communicating. You know, and if I don't advocate for myself – and let my manager know that, hey, I'm really interested in this, and here's how I think it's applicable to us. I think I'm going to miss out. If I wait for my manager to say, hey, you should go to this class, you should go to this training, you should go to whatever, not so good. So as it relates to this, right, so one of the things that people are here at this conference, it's a technology conference, right? How many of these people do you think would go to Toastmasters? Or how many do you think would go to a class in their you know, maybe their HR offers up a business writing class or a public speaking class or anything. Luckily at Wells, we have a lot of those classes that we can just sign up for. You know, a class called Crucial Conversations, where you basically learn how to have those hard discussions with coworkers or family or whoever. You know, the public speaking is one. There's an entire catalog of things related to professional development. But as developers, we go to conferences to get better at development. And you kind of wonder, you know, you think about the resumes of all the people that are going to be here, how similar are all those resumes? Mm. And so one of the questions, I don't know if I'll bring it out in the talk, but if I'm a hiring manager, why am I going to pick you? Because all these resumes are the same.
Right.
And I would argue it's those other skills, right? So I get that you can code, but can you sell that to a CFO? Mm-hmm. Can you get up in front and make that sale? Not from a sales pitch perspective, but if you have that conversation. And I don't think we spend enough time focusing on that part of our career, because we think if we just can code and we can code, then we've got it. So it's kind of fun. I think people probably are going to read my profile before this keynote and say, why are we bringing this database guy up on stage to talk today? Mm-hmm. And they have no idea what's about to hit them, because we're not talking about technology.
Right.
You know, and we'll talk about that. You know, one of the things that the buddy and I were talking about is that there's these permission to play the game type things. For you to get a jersey, you must have these things, right? You have to show up on time. You have to speak with respect with people. You have to do all these things that if you don't do those, you're not on the team. And so you think about a job requisition or a job title, and everything is you must know this code and this language and this whatever, but there's always these required and desired pieces to that rec or life. Integrity, honesty, work ethic, all those things, right? And who has never applied for the job because they're maybe not very good at one of those?
Right.
You ignore them, right? You just assume you have those. But to be honest, there's many people that don't get out of bed very well. Mm-hmm. They're not self-starters. And so I think those are the pieces that start to set us apart,
right?
More so than what you can code and what you can't code.
So as much as I take notes, I should have bookmarked what the last. there's a lot that to unpack there as well.
Yeah.
And that whole idea of getting out of your cubicle. Mm-hmm. And I think you're spot on. All these resumes of the 700, 800, 900 people here. I had a lady named Edie Varley on last week with the podcast, and I really liked how she framed this, that we talk so much about soft skills, and she was like, they're not soft skills, they're smart skills, and people need to quit saying, like, these are skills that people need to develop, because it is. It's being able to sit in that boardroom like we're in now and being able to articulate something to a CFO, a CTO, mm-hmm. on
a product, a technology stack, a direction that we should go for the company, and it's hard to develop those.
But
things.
It's talking to that parent that wonders why their kid isn't playing as much, right? It's those, that entire progression of the dynamic of coaching and the dynamic of just talking with people and with family and church and all that. You know, it's
right.
Yeah, there's a lot there, like you said.
Yeah, there's a lot there. So one thing with your story and with your passion and drive and this 1% improvement is how I kind of took what you said earlier offline of just getting a little bit better and just every day. How irritated do you get with complacency and lack of goals and drive with the people? Like, I don't mean this disparagingly, but man, you've overcome a lot. And when I sit there and complain about my garbage and you're sitting there going, man, I'm in a wheelchair. Well, like, what are you complaining about? What problems do you have that you can't overcome? Does that just drive you nuts? I mean, how do you handle
it? For me, it starts, I'll get to that answer, but it starts really back in college football again, in that, you know, this coach huddled us around one day after practice and basically said, you know, it's okay to have a bad play. And I equate that to a bad day. And if you just have the guts to evaluate whether it was good or bad, step one, can you ask yourself, first of all, was that good or bad? And then the next one's going to happen, and evaluate again. Basically said, you know, you can have a bad play. That's great, as long as you recognize that. And you can have another one that's bad to get that. But after that, somewhere you have to stop that chain. You have to step up for yourself and say, no more. I'm not going to have another one of those. And when you think play to play to play in football as a game is one thing, right? He equated that to, you know, day to day. So I truly believe that no 2 days are going to be the same. One is either better or worse than the day before. And it's up to you to figure that out. You have to have the guts to look, right? You have to decide, you know what, wow, yesterday was horrible, you know? And it might be horrible because you didn't see eye to eye with your kid that morning. And it might be just that one thing. The rest of the day might have been awesome, but in your head you're evaluating, gosh, I really wish I would have done that better or different. And so if we look at that at a day-to-day scenario, it's difficult for me when I see folks that are in a rut. And it's hard because my paralysis is so visible, and we were talking about this before. They may be going through something that I have no idea what they're fighting. And it may be a battle, you know, an unseen battle that I don't dare judge. Where I have a problem is other people that are in a wheelchair that I knew from rehab. One of my best friends, his name's Jim, and we talk about this. It's hard for me because – Wyatt, you're the same as me, you're in a wheelchair, but his injury is totally different than mine. He also broke his spinal cord in a BMX race when he was in his late 30s. We met at the rehab hospital, and I'll call him up. We talk almost every day. I'll call him up, what are you doing? I'm in bed. I'm like, dude, it's 1 o'clock. What are you doing in bed? I'm having a bad day. And it clicks, like, I have to remember that just because I got out of bed, you know, yesterday was rough for me. And it's a little frustrating that way. I think it equates to some of the IT world as well. You know, the older you get, the more you've seen, and the ability or the opportunity to collaborate with people that are at the same level with where you want to go is a challenge sometimes. And I'm not saying I know it all. Like I said, this conference, there's things going on here that I have no idea what they're about. But if I want to have a conversation about where we're going to go with a solution in a certain direction, I have to find that person that's already thought about some of that. And that's a challenge sometimes, even you know, in the cube or out of the cube. You find those people and you hold on to them as your team, right? Across the org chart at Wells Fargo, I know the people that I can call that will take a step back and say, oh, that's interesting, let's talk through that, as opposed to me having to tell them every step of the way through it. So complacency, I have more of a challenge with that with my family and my kids. You know, my youngest is a freshman in high school, and like every kid, has every opportunity in front of her. And I'm waiting for the day when she learns what it means to sweat and work, because when she figures that out, it's going to be a lot of fun. Not that there's anything wrong with it now, but she's at that age where she's going to figure it out pretty soon. And every kid progresses, right? You might have some kids do it earlier, some do it later. But when she's ready, it's going to be a lot of fun. I'm excited for that. So, and I'm not saying it's going to be anything on the court or whatever, But she's already such an incredible kid that it's just going to be really cool. And she says, you know what, I'm going to start taking names and get after it. So
yeah, it is fun just from a parenting antidote. You know, when your kids, when that light switch goes on with things they're passionate about and they go to another level, boy, it's enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
You said something also earlier before we started recording about you would, and again, I may not get this right, but you said, what I heard you say was you would rather not be the leader in charge of maybe like 20, 30 people, but rather be one of those people that is kind of being led. And you had a kind of a good story or a good kind of twist on that I really hadn't heard before.
Sure.
I felt maybe something along the lines like you can have a bigger impact as being kind of one of those people being led.
Yeah, I had the opportunity before I was injured to lead a team of about 15 to 20 like-minded folks in the consulting firm we were in. I led our business intelligence practice. Reported up to our president. There's a few of the guys here that we worked together at that capacity and led different practices within the organization. And, you know, the organization really determined what leadership I could provide. And in that case, and in that situation, you know, you're in charge of marketing, sales, development, architecture, delivery, hiring, firing, I mean, all of that. In the organization I'm in now with 200 plus thousand people in it, in an IT department with 30, 40,000 people in it, I feel that my skills as a developer, a communicator, a storyteller with data, an ability to network and relate with the business first as opposed to focusing on technology, I think I have a lot more value and can show a lot more for the company being that individual contributor and being able to enable thousands of people with the solutions I create as opposed to leading a team of 15 or 20 and trying to tell them, hey, we need to go create this. I mean, it's literally that. I mean, some of the dashboards that we create, when you're thinking about building a report for 5 or 10 people, it's one thing. But when I know my audience is 1,000 people hitting it, and if I get that story right, that's pretty cool.
Right.
You know, and if I can deliver that solution in a way that they don't care about the technology, then I win. Because it's not about the technology.
I want to make sure to honor your time that we're about an hour.
Sure.
And it'll probably take me 10 minutes to unwrap this.
You're fine.
And things like this. But maybe one last question about really kind of, I guess, more about the kids that you're leading and the teams that you coach. What would you like to leave them with when these ladies are, you know, 30, you know, 40 years old and they look back at what has impacted them and they think of you? What would you want them to say you brought to them?
I want them to believe and prove every day in their heart that they're unstoppable. And it's just that simple. You know, and I may be generalizing too much, but I think kids these days, if they work hard, there's less and less competition for them out there in the world. And I think those that work hard and have that belief that they're going to get through anything, they're going to end up on top sooner than they probably realize. I hope to the teams a general attitude and approach that you're not going to get me down. And even at work, when you know somebody's starting to think things are rough, I'm like, I got out of bed today with a miniature gymnastics move, you know, to get into my chair. I already won. You know that was as hard as it's going to get for me today. And so if I can get the kids to believe, you know, it's not going to go your way, but if you come out of it every time being unstoppable and in your mind nothing's going to keep you down, I think we win. And if I can give them that mental toughness, then that's big.
Well, what a great model they have in you. Because everything you've said today and what people have said about you prior to us recording is that would be the word I would use. Is you've got this. You are unstoppable in what you've done, and so to maybe wrap this up a little bit, I do want to acknowledge you. When I started this podcast, again, it was for selfish reasons. I wanted to learn. I wanted to take some notes. I wanted to be able to be kind of held accountable to some prep and things of that nature. And what I have found with this podcast is I have met some life-changing people that I would never
ever would have met or had a conversation with had I not personally started this podcast. This has been impactful for me. And I hope everybody that's listening is really inspired. And Edie Varley, who was on earlier in the week, had a great phrase. She said something along the lines of to inspire to aspire to, something along those lines. So you have inspired me in an hour and 5 minutes, and to aspire to be, to take more action, to be unstoppable. You know, I think that you should stop doing database work and go on the road and start giving these talks.
Well, that's what I think you should be. And I appreciate the opportunity. I think, you know, when Jeff asked, hey, do you want to do the keynote? And I said, I'd love to. And I've done a couple of smaller group ones. And, you know, being in front of 300 or 400 people giving an IT talk is one thing. And I'm excited for today. But he says, I just need you to motivate them. I said, that's all you're going to give me? He says, yeah, that's all I'm going to tell you. Just get on stage and motivate them. And, I might do a wheelie on stage. We'll see, just to show off a little bit. But I would love to get into more of it. I think part of what I think for me makes it real is I can't tell you the medical studies behind why and X percent of people behave and do this certain way. You know, there's no PhD speak to it. I've written some things. I haven't published anything. Just me. And I think the more real I can make that for an audience, right, the better off it is. Right. I'm a developer, I'm a father, I'm a school board member, I'm a coach, and I like to go fast in my chair. So.
Well, I said this on an earlier podcast, and I believe this, is that I think we get so close-minded to what's going on in the world that we don't see the blessings, or what I have phrased as miracles, that we see, that we have every day. That I think we get blinded by that stuff, and we just get in a routine with life that we don't see it. So kind of the mindset I had many years ago was to open my eyes to the great things that are happening every day to me. That way I'm prepared to see them, and I'm expecting to see them. And so kind of what I used to do is I would – at night when I was kind of ending my day would be to write down three great things that happened that day. And I would kind of label those like my three miracles of the day. And then every day I would look forward to finding those opportunities that were life-changing for me. And I set that background to say it is 11:19 on Wednesday, and without question, this has filled one of those miracles of my day.
Appreciate
spending
it.
This hour with you.
Thank
so,
you.
Like, without question. So the last question, though, and I ask this of all my guests, and we've just connected today. I quickly looked at your LinkedIn. I did not have enough time to read your bio. The question I typically ask is, you're my age. I'm 45. I think you said you were 46. At 56, what's your LinkedIn bio say?
Retired. at 56. Hopefully it progresses away from a lot of the tech speak that it has now. Everything in my LinkedIn bio is really based on the endorsements and other things that people have provided, as opposed to me going in and creating it like a resume. In fact, I haven't spent a lot of time on the profile there. For no other reason, I just haven't.
Right.
I think things like LinkedIn and some of those bios get created to try to match a resume search sometimes, and are used primarily for trying to get some sort of employment that way. But I think if I could make it more personable and speak to the broader impact of what's there, it'd be pretty cool. I really like people's LinkedIn profiles that aren't their job title. You know, a lot of the folks here, it's like, what are you? Well, I'm a developer, but it's a different title. It's something more creative in terms of what they are. Like, maybe I'm a data storyteller, and then maybe that's enough, right? But in 10 years from now, I would love to have had some more success racing. I'd love to speak to what we've done, I think, not just with my kids, but the other kids that we've been coaching. And I think the IT stuff's just going to fade away, I think, from a leadership perspective. And as you get older, that's just going to happen. And it'll be less about the minutia of doing the data work and maybe the outcomes of that.
Right. So, is there anything you haven't crushed yet that you're looking to crush in the next number of years? You mentioned Boston briefly. Mm-hmm. you qualify that for the same way that other people would qualify for Boston?
Yeah, so the athletes with disabilities have different time standards like anybody else would, right? So if you're a runner, you have to meet a certain standard based on your age.
Right.
I'm of an age called old, so I'm in a I'm in a different group, but I have to complete a marathon in 2 hours and 15 minutes to qualify for Boston. And I didn't know that going into last year's Chicago, and I finished at 2:16. And it's like, but I never had that goal. And to be honest, I don't know if I really had that goal this spring when I finished in 1:53 up in Duluth. So I totally blew out the time. The kids that I train with have to be under 2 hours because they're younger, right? And so I always make fun of them that, you know, I qualified because, you know, I'm of my age. It's an advantage. So I'm really looking forward to that. I don't think there's a, you know, it's not like I'm looking to qualify for other marathons or whatever. They're just going to happen. And I think I've been told I'm still young that way. My shoulders are still young when it comes to racing, which makes sense. Some of these people have been racing for years and years and years. I'm only 2 years in. I think I've got a lot of things I can offer yet there. And there's a lot of healthy jawing that goes on with the young kids. It's like, you know, shoot, you're only 20 whatever and I'm beating you, what's the deal? Right. You know, and I remember specifically a really good friend named Steven went by me in the race a couple times. I was having trouble with it being so wet and rainy, just the race was spot, and he goes by me yelling, "Come on, old man." I'm like, "Nice, that a boy." But you know, it's good for me to get that from them. And then I turn around and I beat him, so it's okay.
Well, that's great. So to honor your time, one, I appreciate you coming down. This has been one of the best conversations I've had that I can remember.
Like, I appreciate
it. Like, I'm really inspired by you. And I know that you're going to crush it in the keynote today. And I'm really looking forward to that. So I really appreciate your time. Really, when Jeff and Scott said I should be visiting with you, that you'd be great on the podcast, boy, they were right on that. So so everybody listening, we're doing the DevUp conference here in St. Charles. There's a few more people that we may be getting on. I appreciate you listening. Actually, let me finish with this real quick. How can people track you down? What's the best way for them to reach you or get involved? If there are people, is there an association with the racing that you do, that if people are listening that are in a wheelchair, that are inspired by what you've done, are you involved in any charities along those lines?
Yeah, I think the easiest way for all of those questions is just get me on LinkedIn.
Okay.
And I think it's, you know, you can search for my name as F as in Frank, URNESS, and first name's Dean. You'll find me out there. You'll see what's there. And I think just send me a message. Accept a friend, and if you have those questions, put them out there. Charity perspective, I usually try to stay close to the spinal cord associations when I do that. But yeah, any of the questions about racing and some of those things, I'm a rookie as well. So asking me, to your point, is a selfish thing. If I have to look it up, that's good for me. So by all means, I don't have all the answers, but love people reaching out. And if it's a story that you think resonates, you know, with your teams or whatever, I'm game. I love talking about it and meeting the people. So.
Right. So last question, promise. Iowa or Iowa State?
Iowa State.
Iowa State.
Yep.
Okay. And so for some reason, I have a number of friends in this area that are all Iowa State people. So I've met a bunch
without
of
without hesitation.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So, and I forget who won this year. I think Iowa did.
Yeah, they did. Yeah. Not anti-Iowa, but that day I am.
That day you are?
Yeah.
Okay. What they have done at Iowa with this children's hospital
is amazing.
Is absolutely amazing. Is amazing. Anyways, so I appreciate everybody listening, supporting the podcast, the conversations we're having. I hope are impacting you as much as they have impacted me substantially. So I, again, Dean, really appreciate your time in the hour and 15 minutes, and look forward to your keynote today. And appreciate your time, man.
Love it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.